Oregon death row inmate says he's ready to be executed. This is the Northwest Passage on KLCC. I'm Tiffany Eckert. The judge could issue an execution order next week. A new attempt to raise the speed limit to 75 miles per hour on rural interstates. KLCC's Rachel McDonald interviews U of O professor Anita Weiss, who was in Pakistan when Osama bin Laden was killed. And I talk with grassroots community organizer Paul Cienfuegos. He'll be in Eugene Monday for a town hall by We the People Eugene. It's the Northwest Passage on KLCC. Now this update from NPR News. It's 4 o'clock. This is the Northwest Passage on KLCC. Good afternoon. I'm Tiffany Eckert. An Oregon death row inmate is one step closer to becoming the first person to be executed in the state since 1997. Defense attorneys for Gary Haugen tried to get an outside mental evaluation for the convicted murderer, but Haugen himself successfully convinced a judge today to deny that request. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
Gary Haugen was sentenced to death for murdering a fellow inmate at a Salem prison in 2003. Last month, he filed papers with the court asking to drop all remaining appeals that could pave the way for his execution as early as this July. His court-appointed attorneys told a Marion County judge that Haugen suffers from fetal alcohol syndrome and other mental defects. But Haugen told the judge his lawyers are not acting in his best interests. He urged Judge Joseph Gumond not to stand in the way of a speedy execution.
This is my life we're talking about, you know, and I've got a lot of things to prepare for, and I'm cool with it.
The judge turned down the defense attorney's request for an outside evaluation of Haugen's competency. Gumond could issue a final execution order at a hearing next week. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
The body of a 68-year-old Oregon man was found in his pickup truck on a mountain road, along with a journal he kept of his ordeal for nearly 70 days. The Linn County Sheriff's Office said the log kept by Jerry McDonald indicates he got stuck in the snow February 14th. His last journal entry was April 15th. A U.S. Forest Service survey crew found his body Thursday in a sleeping bag in the back of his truck with a canopy. Deputies said McDonald had warm clothing and water, but no food or cell phone. There were no signs of foul play, and he had not been reported missing. The preliminary investigation and autopsy indicate that McDonald's death was consistent with starvation and hypothermia. The Oregon State Medical Examiner released statistics on the number of drug-related deaths in the state. Overall, the data shows a 6% drop and the lowest number since 2005. The lone increase was for methamphetamine-related deaths, matching the highest number to date in this category. Oregon State Medical Examiner Dr. Karen Gunson explains that an increase in certain drug-related deaths usually means there is an increase in availability.
That could be from a number of reasons. While we don't allow the meth precursors to be sold across the counter here, they do in many of the states around us. And there's still certainly an active importation of methamphetamine by drug gangs into the state.
Lane County saw the biggest decrease in total drug deaths, while Douglas and Linn County saw the biggest increases. Methadone topped the list of prescription drug overdose deaths. The U.S. Coast Guard rescued a father and son today after their boat capsized off the Oregon coast. The men are from Idaho and were crab fishing in rough ocean conditions. Both were wearing jackets. They were in the water for about 15 minutes before being rescued and taken to a Newport hospital for treatment of hypothermia and minor injuries. Their names have not been released. A pair of Republican state senators have launched a new attempt to raise the speed limit to 75 miles an hour on rural interstates in Oregon. Senator Bruce Starr of Hillsborough and Senator Jason Atkinson of Central Point are trying to amend a bill sponsored by the city of Portland designed to encourage bicycle and pedestrian travel by lowering speed limits along neighborhood greenways. The Republican senators acknowledge they have an uphill battle. Democratic Governor John Kitzhaber made it clear Thursday he remains opposed to increasing the speed limit, saying he feels it is unsafe. Kitzhaber vetoed a 1999 attempt to raise the speed limit to 75 during his last term as governor. If you haven't voted yet, today is the last day to mail in your ballot, and be sure it gets in it on time. Otherwise, you can deliver it to official ballot drop sites until 8 p.m. Tuesday.
माटी के तुम दीवारे जो सुनो हमारी बात माटी के तुम दीवारे माटी के तुम दीवारे जो सुनो हमारी बात आज मिलावरा पिया का तुम जगियो सारी रात आज रंग है रीमा रंग है री
This is the Northwest Passage on KLCC. I'm Rachel McDonald. Professor Anita Weiss is head of the Department of International Studies at the University of Oregon. She was recently in Islamabad, Pakistan for a conference. Weiss was in the country the Sunday the U.S. Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden. She says the mood of people she spoke with was one of confusion and worry. Weiss says many Pakistanis believe some in the government were aware of bin Laden's presence there, but she says it's unlikely President Asif Ali Zardari knew of it.
Well, I wasn't surprised that nobody briefed Zardari because Zardari's not somebody that the military really looks to as providing leadership. One question that came up in Pakistan, did General Kayani know about Osama bin Laden's presence? And most people think that Kayani also did not know, meaning that there were other people either in the military or in the ISI. The ISI is sort of a combination of the CIA and the FBI in Pakistan. It's the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency. You know, do we think that the highest echelons of people in the ISI knew? Probably not. It was probably much more junior people who just kept it quiet because they thought that at some point in the future they would benefit by having Osama there, or sympathetic to Osama bin Laden. That's certainly, you know, a very good possibility as well. But if Zardari knew, I think the overwhelming sentiment is he would have done something to screw it up.
For you, when you travel to Pakistan as an American woman, is there anything that you have to do to kind of fit in or, modify how you dress when you go there?
That's another good question, Rachel. I've actually been going to Pakistan for over 30 years now. I learned very early on, I'm a visitor in that culture. And so I modify my dress. I don't wear Western clothes ever. But shalwar kameez are so comfortable, I would prefer to wear them in Eugene all the time. I mean, it's the baggy pants and the long shirt and a dupatta, and I'm very comfortable in these clothes. I'm fluent in Urdu, pretty fluent in Punjabi, trying to work on my Pashto. So I generally can understand what people around me are saying. Roughly 10 years ago, I stopped driving a car by myself in Islamabad. And just because a woman on her own driving a car, even in the national capital, it's just not that safe. One day, I was stopped at a light and a car behind me deliberately hit the car. And I knew that, you know, they had broken a rear light. And I just made a conscious decision at that point to drive away. And I stayed with very good friends in Islamabad. When I got to the house, I told them what happened. My friend said, "I'm thrilled you didn't get out of that car. We can afford to change the light. We didn't want you kidnapped." And, you know, you just don't know. Unfortunately, the systems of power and patronage in Pakistan are so strong. I understand how they work, and I understand how people may perceive an outsider. But I think on the whole, what I try to dress for is I look like somebody's wife. I look like a woman who's married to a Pakistani. I was in Islamabad a couple of years ago, maybe. Oh, it was at the time, it was in November of 2007 when Pervez Musharraf pulled the coup on himself. So I had a friend, Sikandar Sherpao, who was the interior minister's son, who called me up and said, "Don't go out. We don't know what's going to happen on the streets. Just stay in your house." So I decided to stay in my house, but I was leaving soon afterwards, and I had dropped off a pair of shoes to get them repaired at the bazaar, you know, at the shoe store. So I decided to, I went out with the driver from the family that I was living with, but I took one of the children in the family, and I said, "Just call me Ami," which is mother. I said, "We're just going to go to the bazaar for a minute. I want you to hold my hand. Call me Ami." So we went, and I was perfectly fine. I mean, because I just looked like somebody who was living in Islamabad, married to a Pakistani. There's my Pakistani child. And I got my work done and went home. So, but I'm also always very respectful of Pakistanis, and I understand local cultural values. This is what I write about, and I've tried to be a bridge between cultures to try to explain the one to the other, from two Pakistanis about the U.S. to the U.S. about Pakistan.
What did draw you to Pakistan? Why do you go there? Why is it important to you?
There's a long answer that we don't have time for, but the short answer is I've always been interested in development and social change. In particular, I'm interested in culture and development, gendered power relations, the role of religion. If you're interested in any of these things, Pakistan is an incredible area to study. I was always interested in South Asia, in India broadly constructed. I mean, you know, the borders of pre-independence India. I had always assumed that I would do my dissertation field research in India. I had gone to Pakistan as a graduate student earlier on what was then called the Berkeley Urdu Language Program in Pakistan. And there is an Urdu mahavra expression, "Agar Lahore nahi dekha, phir paida nahi hua." If you haven't seen Lahore, you haven't been born. So I arrived in Lahore for the language program and was reborn. I mean, there's a synergy between me and Lahore. I love the way people live their lives on the streets. Lahore has changed dramatically in the 30 years I've been going there. It's modernized, it's upgraded, it's kind of lost a bit of its soul, but probably the best field research I've ever done was when I lived inside the old city of Lahore and I wrote a book, Walls Within Walls, Life Histories of Working Women in the Old City of Lahore. The goal being to try to give a voice to people who nobody was listening to. And I think it was pretty effective. I was honored to have won the first prize of the Allama Iqbal Award that was given by the government of Punjab for the best book written about Punjab that was published the year it came out. And they thought I was Pakistani. They never realized that somebody could have had those insights who was not. Pakistan continues to interest me, intrigue me, as does India. And I see India and Pakistan taking real divergent paths, and I'm fascinated by what is and what could be.
Anita Weiss is head of the Department of International Studies at the University of Oregon. She recently returned from a trip to Pakistan. For KLCC News, I'm Rachel McDonald.
You're listening to the Northwest Passage on KLCC. I'm Tiffany Eckert. Paul Cienfuegos is a lecturer and writer who believes corporate rights are at the core of almost every environmental and social justice problem. He will be in Eugene Monday to speak at a town hall meeting of We the People Eugene. I caught up with him in Portland today.
I think most listeners would agree that the environmental situation just keeps getting worse, and the social situation and the economic situation, that we're in a tailspin at this point in the United States and around the world, and we have a very, very tiny percentage of the people of this country making economic, social, ecological decisions for all of us, and they're making very poor decisions. And so what we end up with is a situation where when local communities try to stop environmental harm, economic harm, etc., they're told, sorry, it's not your jurisdiction, you can't do that. So we can't stop GMO farms in our communities, we can't stop the clear cutting of forests, we can't stop our factories from moving overseas and becoming slave wage factories. All of these things, we're told, are beyond our authority. And so people have gotten into this practice, unfortunately. They've been molded into a certain direction of activism where we're always fighting one corporate harm at a time and usually losing, and thus the situation we find ourselves in. And there's a growing movement in the United States to kind of wrestle back our authority, our local authority, to define the kinds of communities we want to live in. And there are more than 120 mostly rural, mostly conservative communities in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Virginia, and Maine that are starting to pass ordinances and ballot initiatives that say we're not willing to live by these rules where we're not allowed to define our community's futures, and we're going to legally take back that power and protect our communities through local bills of rights and ban all sorts of destructive corporate activities. And it's very, very exciting, and any community could do this, and it's kind of a new paradigm opportunity to be taking back our power as we the people. In the current paradigm, local communities can't stop the harms that are being thrust at them repeatedly, mostly by large corporations that want to put factory farms in our communities, want to clear cut, want to mine minerals, want to do fracking, natural gas fracturing of rock to get at natural gas, etc., etc. It's a constant corporate assault on our communities. And maybe Eugene is one of the luckier ones, but even in Eugene, you have situations like big box stores, the corporations want to come in, and the community's forced to use, you know, zoning laws to try to stop them. But ultimately, in the current legal paradigm, Eugene doesn't have the right to stop a big box store. In the paradigm that I and my colleagues are organizing in, we're doing these local ordinances that are really collective civil disobedience, saying we're taking back our right to stop all of these harms. And I think what's so scary in this so-called democracy that we live in is that Americans have gotten to the point that they no longer even believe that they have any legal power, political power at all. So we're kind of, you know, batting at windmills. And we end up feeling incredibly hopeless, powerless, angry, sorrowful, and numb because most of our activities to try to protect our communities fail. So, I mean, I think every American is an expert at watching their communities go down the drain because locals don't have any power to define what happens in their communities within the current legal paradigm.
Will you have practical suggestions for folks who are sitting in the audience and being compelled by the information you're giving but want to know what they can do and how to do it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, like I said, these ordinances could be passed in any community. And so what my talk is about is trying to get people to realize that they can wake up out of this awful paradigm where we're fighting one corporate harm at a time and put just as much political energy into a much more powerful, useful opportunity where we're winning our rights back. We're winning Bill of Rights protections at the local level to define our own futures through ordinances. And Eugene, you know, the state of Oregon and most of the communities in Eugene have the legal authority now to pass ordinances that define the future of their community. And that's the future of this movement.
Paul Cienfuegos is a grassroots community activist. He's newly relocated to Portland and will be in Eugene this Monday to speak at a town hall meeting with We the People Eugene. Weather on the Central Oregon coast tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then a slight chance of showers with lows around 45 degrees. Saturday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and highs to 60. Sunday, showers with highs to 55 degrees. It's 51 in Newport and 55 in Reedsport. In the southern Willamette Valley tonight, partly cloudy, a slight chance of showers with lows to 40 degrees. Saturday, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and highs around 60. Sunday, rain. Highs around 55. It's 66 degrees in Eugene, Springfield, and 69 in Corvallis. In central Douglas County tonight, mostly cloudy with isolated rain showers, lows in the lower 40s. Saturday, mostly cloudy with scattered rain showers and highs to the lower 60s. Sunday, rain showers with highs to the mid-50s. It's 70 degrees in Roseburg. And in central Oregon, tonight, mostly cloudy with isolated showers, lows to 37. Saturday, mostly cloudy, a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs to 65. Sunday, showers are likely with highs to 52 degrees. It's 62 in Bend. This week, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a strongly worded opinion criticizing the Department of Veterans Affairs. In a 2-1 decision, the High Court ruled the VA needs to dramatically overhaul its health care system. The court cited unchecked incompetence at the VA in handling the surge of veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports.
In its ruling, the court wrote that it takes the Department of Veterans Affairs an average of 4 years to fully provide the mental health benefits owed to its clients. It may be weeks before a suicidal vet can get a mental health appointment. Sometimes that's too late. 18 veterans a day commit suicide nationally. In addition, the court found that nearly 1,000 vets in the VA system attempt to take their lives each month. The court also took issue with the way the VA handles disability compensation benefits. Appeals are subject to extraordinary delays.
What they depend on a lot is for most of the veterans just to give up, and most of them do.
Gordy Erse-Palmer was the lead attorney for the appeal, which reverses a 2008 U.S. District Court ruling. The case was filed by two veterans groups. Dr. Bridget Cantrell is a Bellingham psychologist who works with veterans. She says many of her clients have a hard time getting the care they need in a timely manner.
They feel hopeless. Some of my veterans who have been affected by some of the Agent Orange exposure feel as if they will die before their cases are settled.
In the ruling, Judge Stephen Reinhart wrote that no more veterans should be compelled to agonize or perish while the government fails to perform its obligations. According to Erse-Palmer, that won't stop the VA from appealing the case.
The issues in this case, I mean, they're principles. They apply to all veterans. I mean, they apply to all veterans, and they apply to all veteran benefits. That's why the VA is going to fight this hard. They don't want to be subject to the Constitution. I mean, due process, rules, procedures, enforceable procedures. fundamental fairness, that's not the way they do business.
The VA wouldn't comment on pending litigation. The agency could ask the appeals court to reconsider its decision with a special 11-judge panel, or it could ask the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case. I'm Patricia Murphy.
Federal authorities would like to find the man who climbed a razor wire fence in the middle of the night to walk to the middle of the Lookout Point Dam to take pictures. The Corps of Engineers has surveillance video of the March 2nd intruder. The Corps is offering a $1,000 reward for information that leads to his arrest. Officials fear the intrusion could lead to a future threat to the dam. It's on the middle fork of the Willamette River at Lowell. Police say a man caught streaking in a North Boise neighborhood wanted to conquer his fear of being naked in public. Jail records show 19-year-old Jonathan Palmer was arrested on a misdemeanor charge of public nudity late Thursday and has since been released. Police say Palmer was not under the influence of drugs or alcohol and was cooperative during his arrest. That's our report for this afternoon on the Northwest Passage. Production assistance today from Rachel McDonald, Desmond O'Boyle, Mary Ames, Ben Swetland, and Angela Kellner. The theme music for the Northwest Passage composed and performed by Art Maddox. I'm Tiffany Eckert. Enjoy your weekend.
Support this hour comes from Rebecca Bruner in Newport, Kathleen Hallberg in Eugene, and Jan Wooling in Eugene. They all listen and they contribute to KLCC. Thank you, members. Also, support today comes from Safe Corporation, providing workers' compensation insurance and services to help create safer workplaces. Safe Corporation at SAI.